Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. Today's show, we're going to kind of scratch everybody's itch they've been thinking about in the maritime community. But even if you're not associated with our community, everybody's noticed that prices are going up. If you got a project going on, it's being delayed because people can't get supplies, whether it's wood or screws or a dishwasher. And things are changing, and a lot of that impact has to do with how globally people are responding to COVID-19 with a very, very well-connected road. And that's where we're going to dive for today. We're going to look at maritime trade, large-scale economics, and how that's starting to trickle down, not just for the consumer, but also those who make their living in the maritime trades. And if you are with us live, I'll invite you to go ahead and scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find the chat room. We'll be monitoring during the course of our show. We've already got Lee and Steven, and even our guest is there, along with our favorite Cal. So, Mr. Cal, glad to have you. And if you have to take off, remember, if you don't already, subscribe to the free podcast. And whatever you missed or previous shows you didn't catch, they'll be waiting for you. Now I'm going to dive into today's show and returning today to talk about exactly what I discussed at the kickoff is returning guest Sal Marcogliano. He's the chair of the Department of History of Criminal Justice and Political Science at Campbell University. And today we're going to try to talk about the economics, the nations involved, the corporations involved in the global maritime trade, and how that's impacting the consumer, the nations, and also those companies that employ literally millions of people directly or indirectly throughout the world. So, Sal, welcome back to Midrats. Glad to have you aboard.
Gents, appreciate the offer to come back on. It's always a pleasure.
Well, I think to kick off today's show, it's funny that regardless of what type of business you're in or how technical you think it is a people business. And as I was doing some show prep, I came across an article by Reuters that came out at the end of July that, I mean, I've seen these numbers before, but you always focus on things when you're getting ready for a show. And it mentioned a figure that globally, and I'm sure different sources are plus or minus 100,000 here or there, but 1.7 mariners throughout the globe help get global trade going from point A to point B, so the other few billion people can live their lives in hopefully a better way. And of those, since COVID has hit, that there's been 100,000 mariners who are stuck at sea, and another 100,000 who would like to make a paycheck, but they're stranded ashore and can't get out to swap crews and to earn a paycheck. And I thought just to kick things off, because I know you've looked into the topic a bit, let's talk a little bit about those mariners and how COVID-19 is impacting their career and, as a byproduct, their ability to support their families, their villages, and the cities they come from.
I think it's a great way to start it off. I have to tell you, there is a former maritime executive, Frank Coles, who's been really leading an effort on this to really highlight this matter of merchant mariners. As you said, about 1.7 million mariners out there from all the world's nations out there, handling, you know, plus 60,000 ships, roughly. And we count on those 1.7 million mariners to keep everything moving. And last year in particular, in 2020, we saw at the peak, maybe about 400,000 mariners were over their expected duration on board vessels. And for most merchant mariners out there, you're talking about tours from 4 to 6 months. They're prohibited from working more than a year, so 11 months is the max they were allowed to work. But COVID has completely turned that, you know, upend. Mariners aren't able to get off vessels typically on in ports to begin with, let alone outside of terminals. And then to be able to do crew changes has been almost impossible. And so what you have, a situation exists where mariners who are on vessels are stuck on vessels, can't get off, which doesn't sound bad. It's like, well, you're stuck on a vessel, you got food, you got pay, it sounds great. But the problem is your reliefs aren't coming out, which means your reliefs are going to go find different jobs. You're going to lose those reliefs. And then when you do get those mariners eventually off, they may not come back because they don't want to repeat to go through this again. And we're also seeing an increase in accidents at sea right now. A lot of this has to do with the fact that many of these vessels, take an example, the Ever Given, that got stuck in the Suez. That's a 1,300-foot vessel, nearly 200 feet wide, carrying, you know, 20,000 boxes, over 200,000 tons, has a crew of 25 on board. And there's no slack in that crew schedule for anything. And it just creates an environment where it's really difficult. We're putting a lot on smaller and smaller crews. As ships have gotten bigger, the crews have gotten smaller. And I know I'm preaching to the choir here with the Navy audience about this. But it really creates a disruption. And when you look at where mariners come from, the Philippines, from China, from India, from Eastern Europe, one of the things we're seeing is it's extremely difficult. I'll give you an idea. If you want to do a crew change in the United States, to leave a U.S. terminal, you have to have a visa. And that means that you would have to get a visa before you sailed on that vessel. But most of our embassies overseas are shut down, so you can't even do that. So we're having that problem. Add to the fact that it's really hard for mariners to get inoculations. In the U.S., we're doing a great job. As a ship comes in, we're jabbing people in the arms, giving them shots. But overseas, that's not the case. And matter of fact, in some cases, for example, in the case of Indian crew members, they're receiving an inoculation that's not being recognized by some nations. For example, China's not recognizing it. So they're not allowing Indian crew members even into their country. And then you have quarantines where we're seeing outbreaks on vessels. Last year, 2020, we didn't see too many outbreaks on vessels, but with the Delta variant, we're seeing it now. And this has the potential really to create another hurdle in the global shipment of goods.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, that among the other things that can happen with crews is that, you know, the ship owners owe these merchant sailors a lot of duties that are not exactly what we would normally see in a person who works in Dollar General, and you know, the responsibility for maintenance and cure and for providing a safe working place. Are we looking down the road, do you think, Sal, at future lawsuits by some of these sailors who have been trapped on these ships for months?
Well, I mean, the issues you have is, of course, most of these mariners have almost no representation or organization behind them because of where they're coming from. We've seen issues with some of the larger nations. India, for example, have been really adamant about getting out there and working on ensuring the rights of their mariners and their crew members. But what we're seeing is shipping companies, once they start having problems with mariners from a certain area, if they start getting, you know, prices get too high, wages get too high, too many complaints, they'll shift over to another country. And we've seen that happen time and time again. Matter of fact, we're starting to see something we haven't seen in a long time is African mariners being recruited because they can come in for a very low price. Remember, most of the mariners we're talking about, the 1.7 million, aren't Americans. They're not Western mariners. They're not coming from, you know, what we would call the developed nations. They're coming from areas where you can pay them a pretty minimal salary at times to get by. I think the minimum wage for a mariner, and this was in a story earlier this year, is about $21 a day. And matter of fact, some of the big companies were fighting a raise on that because they didn't want to pay more than the $21 a day for their lowest cost mariners. And unfortunately, as long as there's countries out there where $21 a day is profitable, they're going to be able to keep basically getting mariners to crew their vessels.
You know, one thing, make sure I don't forget before the end of the show, I wanted to point to listeners the fact that before we called you, Mark and I were joking. It's not cheating. It's show prep. But if people can't wait for the next time that we have you on Midrats, you have a great YouTube channel, What's Going On with Shipping. And I was watching your latest episode, and you mentioned something that when you said it, I had that feeling that everybody hates to have, is when you hear something that's glaringly obvious that you never thought of. And that had to do with an entering argument. There are a large number of mariners who come from China, tying into your previous comment about the ability to get mariners, to get on board the ships. And if you can't, you're going to go elsewhere, and you might not come back. Is the many parts of China are going into lockdown again due to the Delta variant. And I assume that lockdown is going to impact the access of companies to get those Chinese national mariners. You know, what percentage of an impact do you think that might go if the Delta variant winds up hitting China as hard as it looks like it is? We saw again where they're welding people into their apartments.
Yeah, well, one of the advantages that China has, because it's becoming a larger and larger percentage of mariners worldwide, so many ships are coming out of the East Asia area that they can basically do it during port calls in their area. So China's in a much better position in some ways to do crew changes in that area. But again, this is all part of an effort. One of the things we're seeing in global shipping right now is a cascade of events all hitting at the same time as the Delta variant hits in East Asia. When we're talking about China, we're talking about Vietnam, we're talking about Malaysia, potentially the Philippines, we're still saddled with the issue that we have with vessels that are in huge queues at our major ports waiting to get in. And at the same time, we're seeing, for example, New Zealand had a case where New Zealand's been totally COVID-free. They had a vessel arrive off its port and the crew tested positive, and they're not allowing that vessel in. And so China sees itself in a better position now. You know, one of the things that's been going on behind the scenes that, again, doesn't resonate very high up, but it really should, is that China right now has the largest, you know, shipping company in the world, Costco, the Chinese overseas shipping company, not the Costco, the box store. But Costco is the largest, you know, shipping company in the world. It's, I think, about the second or third largest container liner in the world, but they do heavy lift. They do a little bit of everything. And one of the things that China has done that's very unique, again, some people want to look at this as a Cold War analogy and look at what the Soviet Union doing and the Soviet merchant marine. Soviet merchant marine was terrible. It was never an economic force. The Chinese merchant marine is. And so one of the things we're seeing here is China is developing a first-class navy and a first-class merchant marine. And one of the things they're doing is where ships may not be Chinese flagged, but they're getting those Chinese mariners on board. And they want to really become the dominant seafarers out there, and it's all essential because of Chinese demand for exports and imports. That's their big fear. One of the things I've talked about, and you know, you had Ross Kennedy on, you've had John Conrad on talking about this, is China is just absolutely paranoid about what happened to it in the mid 20th century when Japan tried to cut it off from the Western world, and then how the Western powers were able to squash Japan literally in World War II by starving it. And that's China's big fear. That is the fear that China has. And so getting mariners on board ships is another method for them to ensure that they have a presence out there.
Well, it's not just the impact. There's this UN report, and I've put a link to it up at the top of our chat room. But, you know, they really do cover the seafront on this. Well, I mean, it's crews, it's ports, everything has been affected by COVID-19 that has to do with the shipping industry. And I think we're seeing also that people who had, quote, firm maritime contracts, and I kind of laugh, are discovering that there's going to be some claims for that the big shipping companies, especially the Chinese shipping companies, are ignoring. You know, they're just abrogating their contracts, and I think they're going to make some claim of force majeure on that. Can you kind of talk about that? I mean, this thing is so broad in the industry. It's kind of hard to discuss it.
Well, and one of the things I would always mention is, you know, when last year when we were hitting COVID and everything was shutting down and everything, remember, the maritime industry didn't shut down. I mean, ships kept moving. It never stopped. And so we continually to keep having that flow. And we got into that weird position we were in 2020 where things shut down in China and all of a sudden things trickled slowly into the United States and we felt that slowdown. And then all of a sudden, everybody in the United States started ordering, started, you know, shifting online, and now all of a sudden that floodgates are open, and we have yet been able to catch up. And the problem we had is we had U.S. ports hit by COVID, Los Angeles, Long Beach, Oakland, Seattle, all hit by COVID, so they had slowdowns. But what you're talking about right there, Eagle One, is an important one. There was a story just the other day that came out of a company, I think it's a furniture company in Pennsylvania, and I apologize, I can't remember the name of it, but it had a contract with two shipping companies, MSC, Mediterranean Shipping Company, and Costco, the Chinese overseas shipping company, and they had locked in rates, and they were guaranteed to move their goods overseas. But this company has now filed a claim with the Federal Maritime Commission because what they're reporting is only a third of their cargo that they've booked is being moved on Mediterranean shipping, and less than 2% of their cargo is being moved on Chinese overseas shipping company. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that ships are so stacked off the U.S. West Coast and even East Coast ports that these carriers, and you got to remember, too, the 10 biggest carriers, and these are the shipping companies, the 10 biggest carriers carry 85% of all the world's container traffic. And those 10 companies, none of them are American, and they're orchestrated into these three huge mega alliances that basically are cartels, conferences. And what they're doing is they're prioritizing literally empty containers over American exports going back to the Far East. And the reason they're doing that is twofold. One, there's a shortage of boxes in the world because there's just not enough boxes to move goods, but no problem. China has cornered the box market, so they're building boxes like crazy because, you know, no other country but China appears can build metal boxes. And then second, they want to get those empty containers over loaded containers back because they can send the empties right to the factories to reload with goods to come back. And so literally we're in a situation akin to 100 years ago when we wrote a piece of legislation called the Merchant Marine Act of 1920 where we didn't want to be in a position where our international trade was at the mercy of foreign flag companies. And that's exactly where we are a century later.
I think the economics of that and really the pernicious nature of how that is impacting ultimately our trade deficit, where we have American companies with American customers wanting to ship American goods, and in essence, foreign powers are going, no, we're not going to do that. And I was wondering with that, along with a few other issues, you can even tie in, you want to, the ability to do crew swaps. And we've talked about it with you before on this show, and I think it's a good time to bring it up again, is there's, you know, usually it goes around the Jones Act, but there's a larger thing to talk about the advantages outside of a green eyeshade spreadsheet, the larger utility of having a U.S. flag merchant force, both mariners and ships. Has this experience of the last year adjusted that conversation any, or is there some new scholarship or opinion makers out there that are starting to see some of this experience leading to new reasons to look at this again?
Well, I think you just take an example of Matson Line, which services the west coast of the United States to Hawaii. Matson runs vessels between 2,000 and 5,000 containers, ex- exclusively on that route. They also have a West Coast to China service they operate. But right now, if you were a U.S. exporter and you wanted to get your goods out of California to Hawaii, for example, and if you didn't have Matson, a dedicated line along with Pasha and Tote and Crowley and all the other companies that are out there, then it's very unlikely you'd be getting your containers out there. Understand, one of the things that the shipping companies are doing right now is they are using language in their shipping agreements to basically escalate the cost to move boxes out there. You know, a year ago, you were moving boxes across the Pacific for maybe about $2,500. The most recent quote of astronomical proportions, I did a video on it because it was just so out of the world, was a quote of $32,000 to move a box. And one of the things that we're seeing here is one of the reasons why you want a core competency or a core kind of force of U.S. flag vessels to operate, especially in our coastal trade and in our contiguous trade, is because, again, foreign carriers, and again, I want to be clear about this too. Some of those foreign carriers, you know, it's not all China. You know, Maersk is a Danish company. Hapag-Lloyd is German. CMA is French. But again, they're not under the control of those countries. They're under the control of international corporations, and corporations are seeing for the first time, especially container companies, massive profits. I mean, the amount of money we're talking is in the billions of dollars right now. And what they're trying to do is maximize their profits. Shipping, you know, commercial shipping makes its money not gradually. It's not an investment where you invest in a company and you make 2 to 3% every quarter. You wait for the windfalls, and that's when you rake it in. And that's exactly what's happening now. And this would have been, if Hawaii was dependent on these ships leaving California, stopping in Hawaii to drop off their goods on the way back to the Far East, it wouldn't be happening. And the clear demonstration of that is the number of U.S. containers loaded with goods that are sitting there in terminals right now that aren't able to move. And I'll add another issue on top of this, too, is another story that was under the surface, most people didn't recognize it, was Union Pacific. Again, we're shipping we're talking about, but this is a railway. Union Pacific stopped moving containers off the West Coast and to the West Coast because they had to clear backlogs. Because another feature that's really essential in this is infrastructure. Ports, roads, rails, personnel, you name it. And all that plays into this bigger issue. And we're really at a disadvantage where other nations are developing ports, developing the ability to move goods much more efficiently. It really impinges us in our ability to be a maritime power, I would argue.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you start looking into this stuff, and it's like diving into one of those ball things that the kids used to play with at shopping mall before we decided they're bad for their health. But you know, there always seems to be some new wrinkle. I mean, I was reading that the one of the other problems is that if we don't have enough ships, it's very easy for these cartels or these very large corporations to kind of monopolize the trade. But I understand that since China is a major shipbuilder, one of the things that happened, they've been declaring force majeure on some of their shipbuilding contracts. So not only, I mean, that's one more way to control the amount of shipping that's available if you can limit the number of ships that are available. And I don't, you know, I mean, this thing is, it's just like everywhere you look, it's something sticky that you can see it to our detriment. Now, let's talk a little bit about the effect on our economy with the trade deficit and stuff. Since we're now spending crunch more on shipping containers getting across the ocean, what in the world is that doing to us?
Well, I mean, you saw the numbers for June. I mean, it's the largest trade deficit we've had coming in. And again, when the trade deficit is being fueled by the fact that you can't get goods out of the U.S. overseas, that's a big issue. I mean, we're talking about grain. We're talking about finished goods. You just can't get them off the docks and onto ships and into markets. And what you're seeing here is U.S. companies and U.S. agriculture really suffering at that. And one of the things, too, again, you know, U.S. grain, for example, is a huge provider of food. China needs to import massive amounts of food. 8% of Chinese land is arable. And then if you add the floods and everything that's going on in China right now, they need much more food than ever before. But one of the things that China has done is to make sure it's not overly dependent on one nation for food sources. And so one of the things we've seen them do is go to Australia. We've seen them go to Africa. We see them going to Argentina out of the River Plate area right there, which is having a problem of their own because they can't get food down the rivers because of low water levels. And so China is really trying to come up with solutions to their food sources. But for us, if we're having a problem exporting, then that's something we really need to be looking at. Again, one of the issues I raise a lot is, you know, if you listen to the Sea Air and Land Expo and you listen to the heads of the military, they'll talk about, yes, we need a good, strong merchant marine, but they won't say anything about, okay, what do we do to do that? How do we do that? Commercial shippers are cargo. They need cargo. They need money. They're not going to build a ship for the U.S. military unless they're on a military contract. If they want ships, we have to get cargo. And one of the things we have to be doing is incentivizing for U.S. carriers, these companies, to want to build U.S. ships. But unfortunately, as you mentioned before, the three biggest builders of ships right now are Japan, Korea, and China. And they're literally in a war against each other. It's kind of like the arms race prior to World War I between, you know, the British and the Germans. They're both undercutting. All three of them are undercutting each other. China is running shipbuilding with almost no margin of profit. There was a report out by the CSIS, Hidden Harbors. They talked about from 2010 to 2018, China invested, and I'm going to blank on the number here real quick, but it was billions. I mean, it was hundreds of billions of dollars in it. In the same period of time, the U.S. Maritime Administration, through its Title 11 loan, made available $77 million. They're investing billions, you know, in the hundreds of billions, and I think it was like $316 billion, and we're talking about $77 million. So it's just a quantum leap difference there. And again, to be a true maritime power, you can have the greatest Navy in the world, which we do. But if you don't have the commercial aspects behind it, that's a big problem. If you look at U.S. flag vessels in the Pacific, for example, there's only six U.S. flag vessels of APL that run from the west coast of the United States to Japan, Korea, Guam. That's it. There's six. And matter of fact, there's only five because one of them had a fire on board and it's under repair. That's it. All you got to do is take those ships out and you basically are going to undercut America's military's ability to sustain itself out there.
You know, one of the things that amazed me, especially when everybody's been finding interesting definitions for infrastructure, ports are really no kidding infrastructure, as are the rail links and the intermodal, et cetera, and so forth. And, you know, when you look, a lot of times when you have things that involve the nation as a whole, there has to be action because we're a nation of laws. It's got to go through D.C. And sometimes things get forgotten because they are very narrowly focused in one part of the country. But when you look at the top five ports in the U.S., yes, it includes smaller states like Louisiana, but you also have Texas, New York, New Jersey, California. And if you want to look at the top 25, you're also pulling in Florida, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Wisconsin, those on the Mississippi River. You would think that there would be a lot more action on the Hill by the politicians. Is this a case of economic disinterest, you think, or just complacency that it's just because it's there, it's always been there, it's not really appreciated by those in D.C. who can shape the laws and regulations that can create a more advantageous situation in this particular economic area for the nation as a whole?
Well, first off, I want to thank Eagle One. He posted the link to that CIS report there. It was $132 billion is what China invested. I think one of the problems you have, again, there is maritime activity in so many states. The problem we have is maritime activity has been shuttled off into these enclosed environments of ocean terminals that most people don't see them. And even politicians don't realize the issues associated with them. And the other problem we have, too, is the mode of transportation. We're really at a, I would argue, at a nexus point here where we need to figure out how to move cargo in the next efficient manner. You know, containerization has been around since 1956, when old Malcolm McLean came up with that concept and they moved 58 containers from Newark to Houston. But the problem with containers are they're big, they're heavy, and you need these massive cranes and terminals and a lot of space to move them around in. We really need to be focusing kind of, you know, back in the day of short sea shipping and make it more critical for people in these communities to know. I think, you know, an event like Back March when Ever Given went ashore in the Suez, that opened a lot of people's eyes all of a sudden to, hey, you know, shipping is kind of important. You know, this has an impact. What my daily life is going to be impacted by this when the Colonial Pipeline shut down. And then all of a sudden there was a realization that we had focused the southeast part of the United States on this pipeline, and there really wasn't a backup to move oil in any other way because we've kind of curtailed the Jones Act tanker fleet, although we did have Jones Act tankers that could have been activated. That's a whole other issue there. But I think, you know, again, I think it comes to an acknowledgement of what shipping does. And I would argue, and I'm very hard on the shipping industry for this, they are terrible, absolutely terrible about communicating what they do. And that's the big companies overseas, but it's also American companies. They will not talk about their successes. I'll give you the perfect example. The Ever Given, when she went ashore in the Suez, the ship just astern of her was the Maersk Denver, U.S. flag vessel that had to stop in the Suez Canal in less than a mile without going ashore, an absolutely amazing feat of seamanship, that they were able to stay in the middle of that canal, not hit the bank, not hit Ever Given, and, oh, by the way, got hit by the ship behind them because that ship couldn't do it. But Maersk would not talk about that. They wouldn't make the captain available. It's a great story of success. But they don't like to talk about these things. And I think that's a big issue that we see is the maritime industry is terrible in their own press, and that means that people don't realize how dependent they are on trade. You know, when all of a sudden the I-40 or I-20 bridge in Memphis breaks and all of a sudden trade stops on the Mississippi, people all of a sudden realize, wow, there's also this inland trade that's really important that impacts us. And I think, again, most people just don't understand. It's one of the reasons I started that YouTube channel you mentioned.
Yeah, I am always amazed when you start talking logistics, people's eyes glaze over rather than looking at what really happens. I mean, the global supply chain, if you look at this UN report that I linked to somewhere in that chat room, you know, they said that they surveyed the global supply chains, and 59% of shipping and freight professionals across the world have been significantly affected by COVID-19 pandemic. 25% were moderately affected. Most of the shipping delays and stuff, I mean, it cascades, and we don't seem to have thought through. I mean, we had I think Lee's raising the issue of the American Marine Highway System. We haven't seemed to really thought through how important this stuff is. I mean, the industry knows it, and you're right, they do a terrible job of trying to explain it to people, but we can't even get, as I recall, the Marine Highway System has kind of fallen on deaf ears in a lot of ways. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, the concept of the Marine Highway System, again, this is a MARAD concept, Maritime Administration concept, of, you know, let me move the containers off of I-95 and put them on a ship and move them, you know, instead of me driving it from Boston to Charleston, let me put it on a ship. Well, the fundamental problem with the maritime highway system is this. It's actually not cheaper to do it that way. I mean, because what you're going to have to do is if I load a container in Boston, put it on the back of a truck, I'm going to have to go to a terminal in Boston. It's going to have to sit in the terminal. It's going to have to load on a ship. It's going to have to sail to Charleston. It's going to have to get it offloaded the ship into the terminal, back onto a truck, to be driven to its final destination. Hey, we've got a great highway system in the United States. Diesel fuel, even though it's climbing right now, is still cheaper than places like Europe. It's just cheaper to drive it there. We don't incentivize putting stuff afloat, and we do a terrible job at doing that. And I think one of the issues you have with that is because we built this huge, massive post-World War II interstate highway system, interstate pipeline system. And one of the things we did in the United States was eliminate that Jones Act fleet, that fleet of coastal vessels that we once depended on in times of peer-to-peer conflict. I did two articles for CIMSEC recently on their sea lift topic, and one of the things I talked about is us in those peer-to-peer conflicts in World War I, World War II, the Cold War, and a potential new one. And in the first three, we were able to tap into that Jones Act fleet repeatedly, maybe not always for ships, but for mariners, for the shipyards that maintain those ships, for the repair facilities, for construction. And what we've done is absolutely eviscerate that. And this, I would argue, has a direct impact on issues we see with the U.S. Navy right now, because basically what shipyards do, NASSCO, you know, General Dynamics, Bath up in Maine, all these shipyards, Huntington Ingalls in Pascagoula and Newport News, they're basically de facto Navy shipyards. They really don't build that many commercial ships, with the exception of maybe NASSCO once in a while. And that's because in the 1980s, when we curtailed what was called the differential subsidies, these were the monies that were given to operators to offset the higher cost to be U.S. flag and to build in U.S. yards, those companies went overseas to build their vessels, first to Europe and then eventually to the Far East, and then they just reflagged and put them under the Marshall Islands, which, as a U.S. protectorate, gets them the same protection as being a U.S. flag vessel. It's the best of all worlds for them. And so they just reflag the vessels. But that's had a detrimental effect on the commercial industry, and has, I would argue, a detrimental effect on the Navy, because we're just not building ships. Welders are welders. Yes, I understand welding a Navy submarine is much different. But you lose that skill set of shipyard workers and that industrial base, something that we counted on in the 1920s and 30s that allowed us to build the two-ocean Navy that brought, you know, success in World War II and, by the way, built the merchant fleet that carried the arsenal of democracy from the home front to the battlefront.
Yeah, I had a very frustrating exchange with somebody last week, smart individual, trying to explain to him that, you know, you just cannot stop a production line or close a factory that produces airplanes or close a shipyard and then say, well, we'll need it in 7 or 8 years. You can't hermetically seal that, but more importantly, you cut off the demand signal for the people you need to have the trades to do everything from weld steel to pull cable. And it's a perishable skill set. It's a perishable workforce. And as you know, we've all seen in details, when you have an economic theory like you outlined in the 1980s, where you know you have a theory that sounds good in the classroom, and maybe even in a narrow sense in the boardroom, but when you add in additional variables, it's quite a different thing. But when you have something like that happened for a generation, you've lost a generation of experience for people to train the next generation. And you just cannot, whether it's a nuclear welder or any type of welding, you just can't train somebody in 6 weeks and have them put out and do a ship. You know, one of my favorite examples, you're talking about World War II. Everybody likes to talk about the Liberty ships. And even some of our destroyer escorts were literally welded together on the spillway from coming from different locations. But we had some ships that cracked in two in the transit because we didn't have enough people who knew how to weld them together properly. But let's go to industry a little bit, because you mentioned something earlier on in the show. I was about to go on a rant. Sorry about that. Earlier on in the show, you mentioned about designing new ships and to meet new economic requirements. When you have a big stress on any system like COVID-19 has, it can accelerate thought, if not actual production. And if you have these companies that are generating some tremendous profits, which give them an opportunity to have some extra capital, are we seeing where, whether from an engineering or from a cargo transport point of view, some changes in ship design that will have the fleet of 2035 look significantly different than 2025? And would some of those changes also require, going back to infrastructure, changes on the economics of what makes a good port on our end?
Well, I mean, one of the biggest things you're seeing in the commercial industry before COVID took everyone away in 2020, the big point of 2020 for the maritime industry was this change over in fuel to low sulfur diesel fuel. And the big thing right now is propulsion. Everybody is trying to figure out what the new propulsion is going to be because of mandates from the International Maritime Organization. There's a push to basically decarbonize, or at least to get to 50% carbon reduction by 2050. And that is driving every major company to look at what's going to be the next replacement vessel that's out there. You know, one of the things that the commercial industry is doing is understand is they're not building ships for 30 to 50 years operational life like the Navy does. They build them for 15 years. They build them for 15 years because in 15 years there's a new design out that's more efficient, more cost-effective, and they build ships that are designed to be scrapped and salvaged. Again, your three big builders are Japan, Korea, and China. Your three big salvagers are India, Bangladesh, and Pakistan. So literally your ships are being built on the east coast of Asia and disassembled on the south coast of Asia. And what they realize is we need to figure out what the next. Is it going to be hydrogen power? Is it LNG power? Is it battery power? Is it ammonia power? What's the next big propulsion? And so they're investing huge amounts of money right now in that because no one wants to make the mistake in what the energy propulsion system is going to be. If a country all of a sudden says you have to be zero carbon emission to come into our ports, then that's going to drive companies. If California tomorrow says, listen, you cannot be emission anything coming into L.A. Long Beach, that's going to drive construction of what vessels are going to look like. And usually it's those inflection points, technological changes in vessels are so key. You know, one of the things I'm doing a paper right now that I'm going to present at the McMullen Naval History Symposium in September at the Navy Academy is talking about the Merchant Marine Act of 1920 and how that wasn't just a Merchant Marine Act, but it was actually a maritime strategy. One of the things that scared the British to death about our merchant ships we were building during World War I and under that program was our ships were oil-fired versus coal-fired. Prior to World War I, the British dominated world trade. Why? Because they had bases where they could coal their vessels. They were able to stockpile coal at Singapore, at Aden, at Gibraltar, at the Suez. But now with oil fire, we can put oil in double bottoms, and our ships had the range to go to the Far East and back on one load of fuel. And it changed this. It scared the British to death. And that's what we're seeing right now. What's going to be the big change? Cruise ships. The big push for cruise ships is to go on shore power when they come in. In Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Port Canaveral, all the big cruise ports, cruise ships would come in and run. They would just dump carbon into the atmosphere there. Now the big push is for them to plug in, something that the Navy knows all about, shore power. Hey, you know, I haven't been on a Navy ship where you don't pull in and shift the shore power as soon as you go in. Commercial ships don't ever do that, typically. And that's a big push, is to get that kind of shore power going in. How do we more efficiently move containers than we do? You know, it's a 40-foot box, 20-foot box, the measurement we do. If you look up and down the roads up in the United States right now, you don't see 20-foot, 40-foot boxes. You see 53-foot boxes. You know, is that the next jump we're going to make in that? If we can make a 53-foot container box vessel, that may be the thing that changes what's going forward. And the thing we have to do is to develop the shark tank for shipping in the United States where we can get U.S. investors to invest in this, because the military is not going to do it. They're not. They're too busy. This is the reason why SEALIF recapitalization has fallen on its face, because arguably, and it's true, the Navy is focusing on combatants, not commercial ships. The U.S. is the largest investor in the maritime industry in the world. We just don't invest in the U.S. merchant marine.
Yeah, I'm sitting here thinking about your comments on the port of L.A. and thinking, well, two things can happen. Either they're going to dust off the Savannah, that nuclear-powered cargo ship, pre-container, or they're going to the ports in Mexico are going to really enjoy a whole bunch of new business, because it'd be, you know, rather than conform to California standards, it's got to be a hell of a lot cheaper just to bring your ship into a nice Chinese developed port somewhere in Mexico. The problem
that Mexican port has is its rail infrastructure. It doesn't have it can't handle the rail coming out of there. That's its, or else it would have taken off even further.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking, I'm not to be argumentative, but I'm thinking, you know, enough money involved, that rail problem can be solved. I mean, it's kind of like,
oh yeah,
somebody's going to say, well, it's cheaper for me to send my ships through the, if we can get them through the Panama Canal, that to send them to Gulf Coast ports that don't have these strict California pollution requirements, or, you know, other ports. Anyway, I just the industry's got to take a hard look at, and you're right. I mean, the investors have to see that there's a way to make money in this that isn't so driven, as you talked about earlier, by the boom, you know, kind of like the oil industry where I was participant for a long time, the boomer bust phenomena. You know, you want a steady state growth out of this, not boomer bust.
Well, and I think, you know, I think in terms of, for example, the container industry, I think they've found that. I think one of the things that we're going to see here is once this slows down, and again, you're talking about right now, experts in the field are talking about this demand going on into 2022. You know, I joked in a video back in May to start doing your Christmas shopping now, and now I'm watching, you know, news reports say exactly that. You know, do your Christmas shopping now because things are going to be, you know, in transit coming across and not be on the shelves. And this is going to go on through 2022, but what happens when all of a sudden we finally catch up and things settle down? What had typically happened in the past was you would start seeing the companies fight each other for rates, and you get the rate war. You know, you just basically start fighting each other. The problem is consolidation in the container market, in the bulk market, and even we're starting to see in the oil transportation market, we're seeing consolidation where there are fewer companies. They're arranging themselves in these alliances so that what they're going to do is just limit their capacity. They'll lay ships up to generate more and more profits. And, you know, that's the big danger going forward. You know, even in terms of U.S. military, you know, if there is a peer-to-peer conflict in the Pacific, you know, one of the fears we need to worry about is, number one, we don't have the commercial ships to do the SEAL if we needed to, but the idea that we're going to be able to get Maersk or Hapag-Lloyd or these other companies to carry our goods for us, they may just lay their ships up and not take the risk of being targeted. And again, because for them, it will be a temporary loss to make huge profits down the road. That's what they're seeing. And if people don't believe me, look at the cruise lines that have laid their ships up for a year, and they're still going to be making profits because people will be jumping on those ships as soon as they can. And I think that's the big issue we need to be looking at here when it comes to commercial shipping. Is going to be a much different scenario because, again, this is not the 80s and the 90s where, you know, the top 10 companies controlled 40% of the containers. Now it's the top 10 companies control 85%. And, oh, by the way, that number is growing in terms of how much they control.
And just like the drive for profit and money is eternal, geography is eternal, too. And one of my favorite authors is the late Peter Hopkirk, and he had three of his books that he wrote, nonfiction books. A lot of people are familiar with The Great Game. It had to do with the Russian and the British Empire coming together in Central Asia. And a lot of it had to do with Britain simply trying to stymie Russia's expansion south and her trade routes to Asia. But on the same area, there was his book, Foreign Devils on the Silk Road, and Trespassers on the Roof of the World. And the there's an interesting article out recently that you linked to that immediately had me think of Peter Hopkirk's work, because where geography is eternal, politics isn't. And power structures and empires are always competing and positioning against each other. And, you know, the British Empire spent the better part of two centuries trying to keep Russia away from the riches of the trade to Asia and specifically India. And we've all talked a fair bit about Russia's Belt and Road Initiative. but there's a project going on with, and I also kind of thought of it a few minutes ago when you were talking about quality rail infrastructure. So a little bit is going to have to be worked on here, but Russia's drive to get that trade, especially through Iran, that the Indians and the Russians are working on something called the International North-South Transport Corridor that connects India through Iran to Russia in Central Asia. How is that, which largely goes towards land corridors, but there's a significant move that could affect how supplies and cargo moves from Asia into Europe if that corridor is successful, if that really short sea route from India over to Iran?
Well, there's two things about that really strikes me. Number one is, in a weird way, the United States is indirectly responsible for this, because when we invaded Afghanistan in 2001 and had to supply military forces in there, we fostered the idea of the development of these overland routes. We were shipping containers not just to Karachi to carry overland to Afghanistan, but we were shipping them to Vladivostok and Riga in Latvia, and then using internal transportation in Asia to move goods. And in a weird way, we have fostered not just this concept, which is, again, India and Iran and Russia working together, but also the Silk and Road Initiative, the Belt and Road Initiative by China to do this. China just announced, matter of fact, the other day, that one of the subsidiary companies of Costco, OOCL, is developing a route across, Trans-Siberia, across Eurasian mainland from Xi'an to Kaliningrad to maintain the same gauge rails into that area, and then short sea shipping to Bremerhaven to get cargo to the United States East Coast, Charleston, Savannah, and New York. And again, one of the things that we see developing here is these myriad of transportation networks, so that if one shuts down, there are alternatives. We are so focused on South China Sea and China's claim on that. What China is worried about more than anything else is South China Sea being denied to them. And what does that mean? What does that mean for China? Does that mean the exact, disruption of their trade? How do they get oil? How do they get raw materials? How do they get their export out? And so one of the things that we're seeing here is the development and the investment in these infrastructures of alternative ports, rails, roads, you name it, around the world. Why is Russia hawking the north route through the Arctic, that Northeast Passage? Because they saw an opportunity when the Ever Given shut down the Suez that they can start funneling ships through that route, which, by the way, is 9,000 kilometers long from Shanghai to Rotterdam versus 15,000 kilometers long via the Suez. And so all these countries are going to ensure that they have this. If you're Iran, for example, you are deathly worried about shutting down your ocean routes, about embargoes, about sanctions. But if you have these overland routes, you can get your oil out. And if you're China, you can fuel your economy through the area. Why are they so hard on the Uyghurs and Tibet? Because they've got major trade routes going through the autonomous state of Tibet right now. And so they need to ensure that they have control of those areas.
Okay. Well, how do we solve all these problems, Al? You got 7 minutes to figure out for us.
Well, I'll give you a couple of things from the American perspective. I think, first off, we need to do a better job educating most people in the maritime influence of the United States. I'll give you an example. Mystic Seaport, through the National Endowment of the Arts, does this great history program where they teach the maritime history. I think we need to do something akin to that for public officials, not just national, but state and local, military, where we educate about, the role that the commercial industry plays out there. I think, I will never mean to bash. I've worked with the Navy for a long time. I love the Navy to death. But many naval officers out there have very little idea what the commercial side involves, let alone beyond the American side. So I think that's one thing. One of the places I think that needs to address that is what I call the MCU. It's not the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It's the Maritime Colleges and Universities of America. You know, the six state maritime academies, it's Kings Point, the Federal Academy, and even the Navy Academy and Coast Guard Academy really should be developing an advanced level of education about this, where there's an opportunity to get this out into the local populace. You know, there's efforts by some groups to create think tanks that do this. I think that's great, but I want to see it get out into the mainstream. I think the second thing we need to do is this is a weird one, but in 1961, there was a reorganization plan for the U.S. government that basically fractured the old Maritime Commission into the Maritime Administration and the Federal Maritime Commission. The Maritime Administration looks out, is supposed to promote American shipping, whereas the Federal Maritime Commission is supposed to look out for those who want to ship goods. I think you created two agencies that have the same purpose in a way, and they really should be put back together at a sub-cabinet level below what would be today the Secretary of Transportation. It was under the Secretary of Commerce. Again, we're 199 days. We just got a Secretary of the Navy. We still don't have a Maritime Administrator, for example. And so there really isn't a clear articulation about it. And third, I really think that in the United States, the maritime industries need to stop fighting among themselves and come up with coherent talking points and strategies going forward. The problem is the maritime industry today, you know, we have 180 deep draft ships, but we still have competing unions fighting it out amongst themselves. We have shipyards who are fighting them out among themselves. We have ship carriers who are fighting it out amongst themselves. They really need to realize they're shuffling chairs on the deck of the Titanic, and they're not going to survive if they're not careful. Because these international corporations, which I don't mean to make them sound bad, they're not. They're good companies. They make profits. They're doing a business, but they don't have the interests of the United States in their minds. Their interest is economic, it's financial, and it's their stockholders. And if we keep thinking that we're going to be able to count on Maersk because it's Danish or Hop Hog because it's German or CMA because it's French, I don't think that's a strategy going forward. And we are about to find ourselves in a situation where our logistics, not just the U.S. military, but the U.S. as a nation, can be disrupted. And, you know, we're seeing that right now. We're seeing empty shelves. We're seeing shortages of goods. We all remember how serious it was when there was no toilet paper on the shelf. It's going to be even more serious when cars aren't driving because we can't get key components to them, or appliances and power grids start going down because we've outsourced to the point where outsourcing is not a problem as long as you have the transportation to get those goods in. That's where we see ourselves in an inflection point.
Yeah, and that all goes back to leadership. When you have serious problems, you need serious people. And I think you touched on a problem we have. When you rack and stack what we're hearing from our elected representatives out of D.C., whether it's the executive or the legislative branch, you know, the world's premier maritime power only now has a Secretary of the Navy. Effectively lost a year to do anything. And tying all these concerns together, a serious nation requires serious people. And maybe people need to run out of toilet paper again to really understand that. But if for people, regardless of what political persuasion they are, they should look carefully at whether they're nominating serious people to run for office, because ultimately, yeah, if you get the politicians from New York, New Jersey, Louisiana, California, Texas, Florida, Virginia, and even South Carolina together, how many of them are going to talk about their ports? How do we get that message to them? I think the unions, you would think, you know, people said the same thing about the automobile industry. You would think that more union dues being paid results in stronger unions, so maybe you'd want to increase that workforce some. But it's a multifaceted challenge, and I think in the maritime security environment, And we do a little bit of it here. You do a little bit of it there. We know a few other people that try to bring it into the conversation. But it needs to be brought up more and more where people are as serious about the economic and national security implications of our merchant forces, our merchant capability, as those international maritime organizations' boardrooms are as serious as their profit and loss. And I think we've kind of lost that bubble a bit. How we get it back, I guess it's just well-meaning people keeping the conversation going. And you're, whether you want to be or not, Sal, you know, you're part of that. And I mentioned earlier on in the show your YouTube channel that I would recommend to everybody again. All you got to do is go on YouTube and look under Sal Marcogliano, which after you've been here four or five times, I now can pronounce without hesitating, what's going on with shipping. But if people wanted to keep track of what you're working for, besides sitting in a chair in one of your classes at Campbell University, where else can they keep an ear and an eye out for your work? So,
sure. I mean, obviously, following me on Twitter would be great. At Marcogliano, is I post nearly everything I do on there. I always enjoy that. You're right about the YouTube channel. I started that really after the events with the Ever Given. So I try to get at least two or three videos out a week, sometimes more, depending on the situation and what's going on around the world, with a short little kind of recap of a big or several big stories in terms of commercial shipping that's going on out there. Working on a couple of pieces. I got a piece submitted right now to Proceedings. I'm hoping to hear back from shortly regarding the situation that transpired in the Suez. And then I'm working on two other articles right now. One is on the one I mentioned before, the Merchant Marine Act of 1920 is America's first maritime national shipping strategy. And then the second one is kind of a comparison between the United States, Europe, Russia, and China in their maritime policies right now, how they go about basically handling their policies and what are the positives and negatives of each of those policies, kind of a compare and contrast. Not sure where that one's going to go yet. Still working on that. Hoping to get that one published fairly soon.
Well, whatever you're drinking, making by a double, you're producing a lot of product there, Sal. And I really do appreciate you taking an hour to come share your thoughts and observations with us. Just a great hour.
Yeah,
I appreciate
it. Second
that. Pleasure to talk to you guys.
Yeah, thank you very much for coming on with us.
And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Until next time, I hope everybody has a great Navy day. Cheers.